Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last week talking about geopolitics and the Cold War, and we're, as it were, slowing down because many of the concepts of that period are very much influenced modern understandings of geopolitics, and indeed in some cases people from the relatively early stages of the Cold War continued prominent for a long time, and indeed in some cases Henry Kissinger, for example, have remained prominent and influential to the present day. So what we're going to try and do is look at the concepts, both the, as it were, the precepts, the ideas, but also the practice. And of course, pretty standard historical method here, we're going to draw attention to the difficulties in the face of the real world of applying concepts, but also the extent to which the very existence of those concepts helped limit options and therefore became part of, as it were, the real world. And you know, it's no accident that we're starting with containment, which is very much what you might call a geopolitical concept. America in 41-45 had faced a two-front war, but with Germany in no real position to mount an offensive against the United States, and with that from Japan essentially held in the Western Pacific. Now, from 1949, America again appeared faced by a two-front challenge, one in Europe with the Soviet Union, the other in East Asia with Soviet allies, principally China, Communist China, but also North Korea, and indeed related insurgency movements in places like Laos and the Philippines. America's, in response to this, America's alliance system and bases represented what one might term a forward commitment, one that had been present prior to Pearl Harbor, notably with the American position in the Philippines, but had not then been central to American strategy, in large part because there wasn't what one might term a geopolitics of containment. So the Philippines and the role of American forces in the Western Pacific in the 30s is very different to the role of American forces in the 50s, which again indicates the significance of concepts. What would happen from 1949 onwards was unclear. People could look back at the recent example. They did look back and they valorized a lesson from the late 30s and early 40s, that if America didn't act, but as it were appeased, or acted with insufficient force, as in pressure on Japan in 41, then the result might be a dire situation, at the very least, a surprise attack that caused major problems. As a result of this, containment as a concept was one that was convenient. One must remember that concepts are used not so much because they have any validity, though one can discuss that, but rather because they are, as it were, effective or efficacious in particular concepts. And the intellectual rationale for containment is often held as coming from a 1947 article in the American journal Foreign Affairs by Mr. X. One could mention that if you'd written a journal of equal or even greater intellectual acuity, but it had appeared in, let us say, Italian, it would not have had that consequence. So the very fact that it appeared in Foreign Affairs was significant, whoever Mr. X was. In fact, Mr. X was George Kennan, the acting head of the American diplomatic mission in Moscow. And the emphasis on inherent Soviet antagonism under Stalin, which had been seen in Kennan's so-called long telegram or report, confidential report of February the 22nd, 1946, had an impact in Washington and elsewhere and was the basis for this article. It also, of course, you will not be surprised to hear, helped Kennan's career. In 47, Kennan became director of policy planning in the State Department. And it's worth bearing in mind, one doesn't have to be a cynic, but to note that there's often a large number of competing voices or people saying exactly the same thing, but maneuvering in order to advance themselves in the process. That doesn't mean that what they say is without value. It just means that it's naive not to consider it as in part being at least understood and accepted in that context. Now, of course, however much one might, as it were, write about containment in the perspective of Kennan, that's a lazy person's approach, because the concept of containment was far from new. It had been advanced in particular by the French after World War I in response to the Soviet threat to Eastern Europe. And indeed, the French idea of a sort of barrière de l'Est against Russian expansion had been seen in the late 17th and early 18th century in French interest in developing a sort of effective alliance of, or de facto alliance of Sweden, Poland, and the Ottoman Empire against Russia. And in some respects, what one is getting in the 1920s is a reiteration of that. Moreover, similar geopolitical attitudes and narratives provided a way to manage the transition from British leadership in international relations in the 30s to American predominance. So again, the language was useful in part for the resonances it struck and the political support it could therefore help engender, rather than necessarily as whatever one might be as a free-floating objective account of the world. With geopolitics, it's not, and this remains the case, novelty and conceptualization that is important. Indeed, there is singularly little novelty. I mean, just look at the discussion in the modern world using the term geopolitics, but rather novelty in application. In this case, the late 40s, the key element was arguing that America had a major role to play in containment. In the public debate, this was accompanied, as I've already mentioned, by a supposed lesson from history, history always being willing to give lessons to those people who find it convenient to tell history the lesson it ought to be giving, namely that an American lack of commitment to a European power politics after World War I, and in particular in the late 30s, had led to the failure to restrain Hitler, that in turn had obliged America to act against Germany in World War II. The prospect of chaos was to be limited as part of geopolitics of the Cold War by the offer that June 47, of Marshall Plan aid, an economic aid policy to aid recovery, and in some way to kind of hopefully fix a more benign international order. To a certain extent, this was an unrealistic and futile goal, outside those areas already looking to America, in part because, of course, countries are not readily deployed units. But it was nevertheless a goal that was worth trying outside the West, although it can be argued that it helped what would be anyway Stalin's determination to enforce a Soviet bloc. The Cold War was to be presented in large part in terms of spatial threat. You see that, for example, as how that was perceived not just by the United States, not just by a Western Europe anxious about the prospect of Soviet tank armies advancing through the Fulda Gap on Frankfurt, but also by the Soviet Union. Both sides could use a similar language about threat, and the Soviet Union saw itself surrounded by NATO and other American allies and bases. So in this context, Japan resumed its role as the adjunct of an anti, you know, its McKinderish role as the adjunct of an anti, if you like, heartland coalition, with its navy and its focus on opposition to Soviet submarines, now looking to America as a support and for support, as it had one time looked to Britain. The American sense of threat could be seen in the shape of anxiety about the forward projection of Soviet power. Now, this was seen not simply a concern about possible Soviet influence in Western Europe, but also more generally elsewhere in the world as Western European power declined. So, for example, the concern about the Soviets benefiting from the decline of the British Empire, the French Empire, and more generally, the extent to which there was some, in some way, what would be called a vacuum of power that would be followed there by the Soviet Union. Now, the very idea of such a vacuum, to quote, was inherently a spatial one focused on a specific geopolitics. Of course, a vacuum is a concept that has no real reality because the people concerned may not see themselves as acting in a vacuum. They may see themselves as following their own perception of national interest. But from the idea that if you have no one major imperial power present, that your arrival will move into what is perceived as a gap or a vacuum, you can have a self-fulfilling promise prophecy about which, as it were, fosters your anxiety about threats. And, you know, the very idea provided a sort of dynamic that you had to keep your allies aligned, you had to keep your enemies weak, and you had to persuade neutrals such as Cambodia to cooperate. And for the United States, the projection of Soviet power, bridging, as it were, earlier containment. So there was the 1950s containment, such as CETO in Southeast Asia, CENTO, NATO. And then, of course, in the 60s, this gets bridged with, you know, forward projection of Soviet power to Cuba and to Egypt, Soviet bases being developed in Soviet interests being developed in Somalia. All that that does is further foster anxiety. Whether that anxiety is a realistic one is another matter of opinion. I mean, you could argue that, of course, if you move into an area, you end up propping up a useless regime, expending considerable resources to do that, and don't necessarily gain much commensurate benefit. But that's not how geopolitical thinkers tend to conceptualize their understanding of international rivalry. What containment and indeed the Cold War meant for American policymakers was far from fixed. Instead, there was an essential fluidity which extended to areas and to threats. For example, on the 5th of January 1957, this is in the aftermath of the Suez Crisis of 56, President Eisenhower announced to Congress what was to be termed the Eisenhower Doctrine. This permitted the commitment of American forces in the Middle East, quote, to secure and protect the territorial integrity and political independence of such nations requiring such aid against overt armed aggression from any nation controlled by international communism. End of quote. Interesting doctrine. And of course, obviously, without international communism being part of the equation, you can see aspects of this in American policy today. Now, in the context of 1957, the Eisenhower Doctrine, so-called, might appear clear. But in practice, the threat in the Middle East at that point was from Arab nationalism and internationalism and not from the Soviet Union. And that did not make it clear how best to define those circumstances in which America should intervene militarily. Aside from deliberate or unintentional obfuscation about the international situation, one seen later when Iraq was attacked in 2003, the fluidity in American policy in part arose from domestic political, social, and cultural pressures, and they helped cause hostility to foreign powers that were presented as linked to the internally, as it were, the eternally dangerous Soviet Union. And, you know, you could argue, it has been argued, that, for example, this helped to alienate Iranian nationalism from America, etc., etc., ditto for Cuban nationalism. I think that that can be a little simplistic, that criticism. But on the other hand, it must be said that the Americans, like the Soviets, were not always terribly sophisticated in their understanding of the political dimensions of rivalry in the global South countries. There were clearly real tensions, and the real tensions arose from the opportunities created and problems arising from the end of the Western European empires, both opportunities and problems during the end of those empires, France in Algeria or Britain in Korea and Malaysia, were just some of the instances of often a troubled end to empire that could be exploited, but also subsequently the end of empire, far from, as it were, offering an Elysian future of happy democracy, created often a series of unstable, violent, and authoritarian regimes, which in part expended their energy competing with each other. And this provided opportunities to maneuver at all sorts of levels for all sorts of powers. So, for example, Egypt, which had primacy and geopolitical interests across the Arab world, is a player which is an independent player. It takes up with the Soviet Union and subsequently abandons the Soviet Union. And the danger is that one configures some of these states, some of these players, as if they're fixed within one or other alignment. In the US and in the former colonies, there was optimism with decolonization, notably in the shape of growth and of economic growth and social and political development through modernization, whether that was American or communist in agenda. Modernization was regarded as a form of global New Deal, able to create liberal capitalist pro-American democracies. Conversely, modernization was regarded by communism as being able to add depth, resonance, and range to the communist agenda. The practicality is, of course, that decolonization, and it's ironic now that it's been endorsed as a kind of ideology or pseudo-religion by a variety of sort of self-interested and rather foolish interests today, because the practicality of it in the 50s and 60s was often that of brutality and great harshness. And, you know, if you're looking at the large-scale violence of the 60s, people tend to focus on the Vietnam War. But in terms of, for example, conflict in Congo or conflict in Nigeria, the Biafran Civil War, these easily matched, in some cases you might argue, surpassed the casualty figures in Southeast Asia. The dynamics of threat and fear for the West ensured that hard power was part of the equation. It wasn't just a matter of perception and whether you understood or failed to understand so-called third world nationalism. By 1950, the Soviet atomic warheads test and Mao Zedong's conquest of China in 49 had transformed the parameters for American both strategy and capability, the two being linked. The preemptive action that the possibility of airborne nuclear attack appeared to make necessary, the fear that, that Soviet bombers, particularly if they only went one way, as it were, they were a kind of kamikaze bombers, which was an American anxiety of that period, with carrying nuclear bombs. The fear that this might happen appeared to make necessary preemptive action, which provided what you might call a new take on strategy or a new take on geopolitics, as the space-time sequence was radically altered. In part, this was a matter of the range of aircraft and the greater practicality of such attack. But alongside technology, there was also the learned experience of the damage that could be inflicted through surprise attack, in short, the prospect of another Pearl Harbor. Indeed, NSC, National Security Council 68, the basic document of containment, was a prime instance of fear-driving policy, or at least of fear as a selling point, both within government and towards the population as a whole. The fact that the communist bloc had greatly expanded from 39 to 49 and had now gone nuclear, taking over much of Eurasia, posed issues for Western powers of containment, deterrence and defence. Whether these were practical fears is another matter. In a sense, in the aftermath of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, it wasn't clear that people had the possibility of determining what was practical. And that was enhanced as the lethality of nuclear weaponry was surpassed by the lethality of thermonuclear weaponry with the hydrogen bomb. These issues of containment, deterrence, and defence were accentuated and brought to the fore in 1950, when an attack was launched on South Korea, a state supported by America. In response, in a classic instance of shoring up a system, one that had a political logic, the NATO Council agreed on December the 18th, 1950, to a strategy of forward defence, which meant holding West Germany against Soviet attack. So if you're thinking about modern counterparts, what you've got here is action by an opponent of America in one part of the world, leading to an American enhanced commitment in another part of the world. So, you know, again, what that underlines is that nothing is predictable, because that might happen, or the opposite might happen. It can lead to a retrenchment and drawing in of commitments in other parts of the world, so that one is better able to confront the challenge that one now faces. In turn, this new American commitment affected planning, deployment, and force requirements, each of which created a dynamic that helped frame what you might call a geopolitical context. And in America, policymaking, though not always public rhetoric, understood that that the European and East Asian spheres were linked. Now, that was a very important point, because that remained absolutely fundamental to American policy during the Cold War. And it really can be seen as playing a crucial role in American state policy, if you like, at the present moment. I think it's fair to say that the public understanding of this, though, has always been more fractured, more fragmented. And the kind of attitude now that you see among some Republicans, or many Republicans, the sort of, you know, let the Europeans look after Ukraine kind of thing, it's got nothing to do with our interests, which is a flawed analysis, because clearly the collapse of Ukraine would encourage other opponents of the United States. But that analysis actually has a long genesis, because there is often been a sort of support for this kind of, we should focus on what is just immediately central to us. You see it, for example, during World War II, among those people who were wary of Roosevelt's Germany First policy, and what, oblivious of the fact that the Germans had actually declared war on America. America didn't have a choice as to whether to fight Germany, but themselves rather preferred a Japan First policy. If one sort of looks at the fleshing out then of the American sort of Cold War geopolitics and their infrastructure in the 50s, what one can see is the development of alliances and bases intended to substantiate the new alignment. So, for example, America was very keen on developing a good relationship with Portugal, which became a founding member of NATO in 1949, even though Portugal was not a democracy. Spain, which was also not a democracy, and also Portugal was fascistic, Spain was more fascist. Spain was not allowed into NATO, but of course America signed a defence partnership, including air bases, in 1953. 1951, there was a defence agreement with Iceland, a democratic NATO member, which ensured that America could use the base at Keflavik, which it in turn paid to develop. So in other words, the Americans were acquiring much more significant aerial control, would be the wrong word, but presence in the North Atlantic, linked also and also the British air bases played a role, to the idea that American forces in Western Europe could be readily resupplied from the American homeland. And the same thing could be seen specifically in Western Europe. The leading air transport terminal in Europe and of key significance for the American presence in West Germany was the massive Rhein-Main air base just south of Frankfurt. As a result, incidentally, the roads focusing on Frankfurt were rapidly repaired and improved by the American occupation forces, which was an instance of the important local aspect of the infrastructure of air power geopolitics. And the American network of bases was not restricted by NATO, but was also seen in Japan, it was seen in the Philippines, and was seen in a way with the development of large aircraft carriers, which became a sort of movable feast of geopolitical power. Again, one can see that in the present crisis in the Middle East. We're speaking on the 31st of October, with American naval-based air power, which is highly capable, a significant presence in the East and Mediterranean, raising, interestingly, the question of what would happen if one of the American carriers was actually struck by a hostile missile with casualties. The British were, of course, part of the same process. I mean, if you look at the aircraft carriers, for example, in order to have a nuclear strike capability, American carriers had their flight decks strengthened in the early 50s while steam catapults were used for launching aircraft, which means you can carry heavier aircraft, which means you can carry more ordnance, including atom bombs. As you will know, atom bombs are heavy. So technology doesn't just sit there in a vacuum. It has practical needs and possibilities. Aircraft carrying nuclear bombs required also more fuel for their greater range, and again, were therefore had a heavier payload. And the British were part of the same process. They developed their naval bases under the Anglo-Celanese 1947 defence agreement that was part of the independence process. Britain was allowed to use the island's naval and air facilities in future emergencies, notably the major harbour at Trincomalee, which is one of the greatest natural anchorages in the world. Even impressed me when I saw it. This agreement lasted until the Suez Crisis in 56 led Ceylon to abrogate it as a form of protest against British action. The British tried to develop bases elsewhere, including, for example, a naval base in Western Australia. They tried to develop an integrated Commonwealth Far East fleet, and they planned for and pressed for a new generation of large carriers, one that was eventually to be cut short in the mid-60s. Yet geopolitics is precisely, as I've already argued, and as we will argue throughout, not a geographical determination of politics, but a politics that, as it were, reflects on geography and has a geographical context. Context does not mean determination. For example, the response to the North Korean invasion of South Korea and later to Chinese intervention in that war, both of which occurred in 1950, was far from inevitable. There was no geopolitical reason which said that the Americans had to act, or if indeed, if they did act, that they should act in a certain fashion. There had been indications in the winter of 1949 to 50, indeed, that America did not see South Korea as within its defense line, which is rather like the argument that in 1990, the Iraqis didn't appreciate adequately that the Americans would fight over Kuwait, and rather like the argument that in 1982 the Argentinians did not appreciate that the British would fight over the Falklands. But one can turn that on one's head, and one can say how stupid, etc., etc. Turn it on its head. How many listeners know whether the Americans would fight and in what context they would fight if there was an invasion of Taiwan? So particularly as it were, hostile steps the Chinese might take towards American forces might change the equation. One doesn't know. One can speculate, but even in the event of a crisis, and even if there are protocols before the crisis that apparently determine process, they do not actually determine it. The policy very much does, policy, process, protocol, as it were, does not sustain the first shock of action. Even more so in a world which is now more inclined to pile on the pressure visually and through popular opinion. In 1950, there was an American response which Kim Il-sung of North Korea had not anticipated. In turn, the Korean War strengthened the Western alliance and led to American support of Taiwan, which had not been something that had been obviously obvious as likely to happen. And, you know, this became a not so much a controlled, limited war, but a conflict that escalated in unexpected ways and where deterrence didn't work. Chinese intervention in late 50 was a key instance of both, and by 53, Eisenhower was threatening to use nuclear weaponry in order to bring the conflict to a close. This is not what had been anticipated in 1950. Politics, moreover, should be understood in the widest sense as including policy formation and differences within government. And that includes authoritarian governments like that of North Vietnam. There's been some good work on how within North Vietnam during the Vietnam War, there were different tendencies in the Politburo and that their politics was important. Thus, in the early 50s, there was debate in America, not so much as in the late 40s about whether it should commit against communism, but rather how far interventionism should extend. There had been talk of the rollback of the Soviets in Eastern Europe, again, a fascinating use of language. During the 52 elections, the Republicans, some of whom had accused the Truman administration of having lost China, had rejected containment as too passive, called for rollback, and spoke of, quote, captive nations in Eastern Europe. And this was a way to present the government as having squandered the legacy of World War II. So in other words, politics, whether you want to call it geopolitical or not, politics took place in terms of a rhetoric of space-time continuums that are worth thinking about. Now, what we've done really today, and we're going to continue next time, today we've looked at the very end of the 40s and the very beginning of the 50s, and including the Korean War. What we're going to do next time is press on after the Korean War, which, just to remind people, ended in 53. But I hope that's given us something to think about in the meantime, some of which has direct relevance to the present day, at least in terms of unlocking ideas. And Graham, do you have any suggestions on what we've been covering?
Well, Jeremy, it's given me a lot to think about as you discuss this period. I think one of the key questions for me is disinterring the difference between a geopolitical strategy and a response to unwelcome events. So really just to start that process by going back to Mr. X, to George Kennan, his telegram, his article in Foreign Affairs. Is he a figure you could say was influenced by geopolitical considerations, or was he just someone shocked by what he saw about Stalinist Soviet Union and wanted to convey the level of threat and didn't propose or develop in any detail a forward-thinking geopolitical analysis of where that would lead, whether that would lead to the Eisenhower doctrine, for example?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, Kennan, of course, is writing against the background of a very fluid situation in which the threat posed by and the ambition posed by Soviet expansionism is becoming more urgent. And he is trying to say to people, we've really got to rethink American strategy. These people cannot be happily dealt with in the sense of just chatting to them. We need to have some really clear-cut way in which we integrate our concerns and then plan how to assuage them. I think that, you know, that was a reasonable point. The Soviet Union had operated far more rapidly to subjugate non-communist movements in Eastern Europe than people would envisage. And what Kennan was arguing was that the notion of détente, and you could suggest there'd been a détente with the Soviet Union from 41, that the détentes would be simply short-term periods in which the Soviet Union would pursue its interests by different goals. This argument was to be taken up in 1959 by a chap called Robert Strauss-Huppe, who was an interesting one because he's a political scientist who ends up as a influential American ambassador to a number of places, including Ankara. And he argued in his book, Protracted Conflict, he, in a sense, develops Kennan's one. And there's a sort of call for vigilance. So this is the theme that one has got here, that the prime needs, the prime requirement is vigilance. Now, vigilance does not necessarily mean what you're going to do in a specific, crisis, but it does mean that you shouldn't, as it were, have to be cranked up from a zero position to start off with.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm intrigued by this whole question, and the question of to what extent is particularly America responding to events. So would it have taken a more forward position in Taiwan if it hadn't decided to get involved in the war in Korea? If the war in Korea had gone badly wrong, would they have decided that Taiwan was not a geopolitical concern for the United States after all? You know, circumstance would have restricted the geopolitical appetite. I wonder how fully these things were worked out, or whether geopolitics really follows in the shadow of experience.
Well, I think to a great extent, the latter, and as I've said, I mean, I'm not sure that one would ever suggest that there is only one way of looking at the situation. And indeed, geopolitical language, geopolitical rhetoric, geopolitical phrases are simply one among a number of ways in which you can conceptualize international relations and prioritize them, both in terms of analysis and in terms of arguing for particular policy prescriptions. As far as the late 40s are concerned, there is, and this shouldn't surprise one, there is an argument that, you know, America is demobilizing. It is trying to, you know, it's been exhausted by a major war in which a lot of manpower, a lot of resources have been used. There is a desire for peace. You can see how the Marshall's decision, wise decision that America should limit any commitment to the Chinese Civil War, reflects that. And people like Kennan are saying, for God's sake, it's serious out there. Don't just think in terms of a peace dividend. And again, it's interesting to think of modern parallels. I mean, you know, we can debate what they are, but, you know, it's interesting to think about them.
I don't want to predict future episodes and where we're going to get to, but just in this early phase, late 1940s, early 1950s, to what extent was Roosevelt's anti-colonialism tempered by his successors taking the view that actually the European colonial powers continuing to have bases in Africa, in the Middle East, in the Far East was actually very useful for America to be able to project its power geopolitically, given that America could not be everywhere all at once and in full force.
Well, I think it's fair to say that Roosevelt was very hostile to the British Empire, that Roosevelt didn't really understand the practicality of Western imperial power, and that he was too ready to absorb anti-British rhetoric, and he was actually not very really impressed by the other European imperial powers. So that would be my perception of it. I mean, obviously, Roosevelt isn't a villain in the way that Stalin is, but I think Roosevelt can be argued to be a bit of a fool.
Yes, but how rapidly after that did he change? So by the end of Truman's presidency, would you say that Rooseveltian animosity towards European colonialism has gone in favour of a entirely practical approach to, well, actually, it's quite useful to Americans, American global influence, so we don't want to get in the way of its decolonization.
I think the major change occurs in the aftermath of the Suez Crisis. I think there is a realization by that the British bolt from empire is going to be producing new areas of instability, as with that of France and Belgium. The Belgium Congo from 1960 is a source of anxiety for the Americans. In the case of Southeast Asia, where the French had departed in 54, much against the desire of the Americans, by the early 60s, there's concern about, in particularly Laos. Ironically, of course, it's Vietnam that is to become the centre of American sort of worries, but initially it's Laos. And again, it's quite clear for the Americans that they're being thought to have to take a forward role because the imperial powers are departing. And as the 60s roll through, you get tension, for example, between the British and the Wilson government after 64 about the speed of British withdrawal from east of Suez. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll return to that theme and others as well in subsequent episodes. But for talking us through geopolitics and the early phases of the Cold War in the late 1940s and early 1950s, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.